Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What was the role of Great Britain in the U.S. Civil War? As a key trading partner to the United States in the mid-19th century, Britain's economy was seriously and directly affected by the Civil War's blockades and supply disruptions. And while the British government was officially neutral in the conflict between the Union and Confederate states, individual subjects were quick to take sides, along with many of the British journalists who sent reports back home. Author Amanda Foreman is visiting research fellow at Queen Mary University of London and covers this little-told side of the most devastating conflict in American history in her book, A World on Fire, Britain's Crucial Role in the American Civil War. The book is available now in paperback. Amanda, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about the diplomatic relationship between the U.S. and Britain in the years leading up to the Civil War.
Well, if you were to compare it to a family relationship, then it would be one of those incredibly dysfunctional families where there is invariably blood on the carpet by the end of Christmas Day dinner, and yet there's something that binds them all together, and they can't seem to let go of each other.
So they keep getting together despite the conflict.
That's right. The passions that were always simmering below the surface and then would explode periodically were very much like that of a parent, in this case Great Britain, and a furious teenager, which would be the U.S. And it's hard to imagine that today, when the teenager has become the elder statesman and Great Britain is now the tottering grandparent that doesn't want to get left behind. Back in the day, in the 1860s, Great Britain was the most powerful country in the world, and the U.S. was still small and insignificant and had the diplomatic heft of, say, what Finland has today.
Yeah, and in fact, the U.S. didn't even merit an ambassador, a diplomat of that level, to be sent from Great Britain.
That's right. I mean, at the beginning of the war in 1861, the U.S. Army was about 15,000 soldiers. It had no navy to speak of, and as you say, it didn't merit the status of having embassies or ambassadors anywhere in the country. And in fact, there were only about 17 or 18 diplomatic missions in the U.S. And they had the level of legations, which is one below an embassy. So there were no actual ambassadors, and most of those missions were from Latin American countries. But one reason for that, though, was because Washington, D.C. was considered a hardship posting, partly because the weather was so terrible. It was hot and dusty and smelly in the summer and cold and wet in the winter, and also because it was like a one-horse town. It had nothing except the White House, some public buildings, and that was it. Very, very little commerce. No theater to speak of, no concerts, no music. And so for diplomats who were used to going to Vienna or Paris or London, to find themselves in Washington, D.C. was like being exiled to Siberia.
So in 1859, that short straw is drawn by Lord Richard Brickerton Pemmel Lyons, which, by the way, is one of the most marvelous English names, I think, in the book. and he's sent to represent the Crown's interests in Washington. And he's sort of an oddball for the job.
Yes. Lord Lyons was one of those diplomats who was a slow burn, in the sense that he started out in life and in his career as very unpromising material. He was incredibly shy, which is actually disastrous for a diplomat. And he had such trouble looking people in the eye that his servants, for example, were known to him by the color of their socks and shoes. He could always tell who had come into the room because, John the butler wore stripy socks and, Mary the maid wore green socks. And it took years and years for him to muster the courage to actually look people in the face when he spoke to them. But even then, he was so loath to confront people, especially people whom he liked, that he put up with having a breakfast that he hated because he didn't want to hurt his valet's feelings and tell him that actually he didn't like eggs. You know, he was that kind of man. So not ideal for a posting in America. In Europe, eccentricity was slightly more tolerated in those days. And once people realized that beneath the shy exterior was an incredibly cultured, actually quite witty individual who was well-read, very good at playing whist and bridge, and a very good and loyal and kind man, you know, they got to like him. Whereas when he turned up in the U.S., all they saw was this slightly rotund, ungainly, shy individual who didn't drink, who didn't smoke, who, in some ways was more comfortable talking to women than to men, and had none of that kind of hearty, tub-thumping, cigar-chewing bonhomie that was popular in D.C. at the time.
Meanwhile, on the other side of the pond, the U.S. sends Charles Francis Adams, son and grandson of the U.S. presidents, and he is another unlikely choice.
He really is. The Adams family at this point represented the kind of royal diplomatic and political royalty that the Kennedys represent to the public today. And, that is and can be a poisoned chalice. So Charles Francis Adams, who was the son and grandson of American presidents, who had also served abroad as U.S. ambassadors, or we should say ministers, to England, seemed like the obvious choice on paper. Adams had been to England when his father had been representing America to the court of St. James. So you would have thought he was ideal. But in fact, he wasn't. He was burdened by having this Adams legacy, this great expectation that he must be something and do something. And he was, in fact, a quiet man who didn't drink, he didn't smoke, he didn't like to dance. He hated small talk. He didn't like strangers. He liked to be at home with his family, looking at his rock collection.
So let's talk about the trade relationship between these two countries. And particularly of importance was the southern cotton supplied to British textile mills.
At the beginning of the war, one in five Englishmen, one in five workers was employed in some way by the cotton industry, owed their livelihoods in some way. So we're talking, 500,000 workers in the mills alone. There's an extraordinary dependence. I mean, cotton today would be translated into, the oil industry. It was that kind of relationship. And the South was banking on being able to use this relationship, this dependence that Britain and its industrial might depended on cotton. And they thought, well, if we just turn off the spigot, then we'll be able to blackmail Britain into recognizing southern independence. It's going to be as easy as that. What they hadn't reckoned on, though, was that in 1859 and 1860, the South had produced its largest cotton crops in its history. And this had actually produced a cotton glut. And many merchants and mill owners in Britain were facing bankruptcy. Their warehouses were groaning with the stuff. They didn't know what to do with themselves. And just at that point, when they feared the very, very worst, the war broke out in the U.S., and this unofficial, was never actually legally mandated, but this unofficial cotton embargo began. And people were just whooping with joy, at least the merchant classes were whooping with joy, because that gave them the breathing space to empty their factories and their warehouses. And so there never was a glut. It took 18 months to use up all the cotton and linens and materials that had been waiting to get sold off. And then by 1862, there was indeed a cotton famine. But by that point, there was just enough of an alternative, just enough sources in India and Egypt and elsewhere, so that there wasn't this total embargo that might otherwise have you know, led the South to victory.
You know, it's so interesting now because we know how long the Civil War lasted, and so it seems that that amount of time was predetermined. But at the start of this, we have to remind ourselves no one realized it would go so long.
That's right. I mean, there's that wonderful, very poignant comment that a leading Southern politician had made at the beginning of the war when he'd said, you know, he expected to be able to wipe up all the blood that was going to be spilt over the secession desires of the South with his handkerchief. Then, you know, after the war, he realized what a terrible, awful, stupid thing to have said, and how wrong he was. And I mean, no, you're right. At the beginning, no one really thought it could come to what it did, and it caught everyone by surprise.
So let's talk a little bit about the ideological sympathies within Britain, because slavery had been abolished sometime before. Pretty much every British subject found the idea of slavery abhorrent. And yet there was, in certain circles, a great deal of sympathy for the cause of the Confederacy.
Yes, I think there is much to learn from this aspect of the Civil War. And I think every student of propaganda, every student of the media, and public policy should study this extremely carefully, because at the beginning of the war, British sympathy was completely behind the North and completely against the South. At the beginning of the war, what people in Europe, and especially people in Britain, which is where opinion really counted, believed that this was indeed a war about slavery. They understood that, you know, South had slaves. They thought that the North didn't. And therefore, this was a war that was going to result in the end of slavery. And therefore, you know, they should put their support behind the North, not behind the wicked Southerners who were threatening to blackmail Britain with a cotton embargo in order to get their, you know, independence recognized. So you would think, so what went wrong? How could you have this total turnover of public opinion, which is what happened? Well, what wrong is this? First of all, the Secretary of State, William Henry Seward, made a colossal diplomatic error. And he did that because he was thinking domestically, not internationally. And that is often the fault, I'm afraid to say, of Secretary of States in this country. He thought that if he could just find one single cause, something that united all Americans, some emotion, some, you know, some national sentiment that could unite all Americans, then secession fever would go away and, you know, there would be no war. And he thought, well, there is no greater common feeling than hatred of England. And so he tried everything to provoke Britain into saying something or doing something. He threatened, he blustered. He tried to get England to become an aggressor, because he knew that the British weren't interested in having a war with the North. So he did everything he could in order to make it seem as though there was a war or about to be a war with Britain, and so the South would come back on board. And he failed in that, and all he ended up doing was turning the British government from being a willing ally, and there are many letters between London and its embassy in Washington, D.C., and the ambassador, Lord Lyons, talking about this and saying what a shame it is that we can't support the North, because they seem to want to have a war with us. So he lost that support.
Amanda Foreman is my guest. She's visiting research fellow at Queen Mary University of London. Her new book is called A World on Fire, Britain's Crucial Role in the American Civil War. The book is available now in paperback. If you'd like to join this conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Amanda Foreman. She's visiting research fellow at Queen Mary, University of London. Her book is called A World on Fire, Britain's Crucial Role in the American Civil War. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Amanda, it's worth coming back to William Seward for just a moment to remind people that on top of everything else he did, he also really, really infuriated British leaders by saying, oh, and by the way, we plan to annex Canada as soon as we get around to it.
Yes, that's right. I have to tell you that I really adore Seward. I really do. He's this larger-than-life character, and in an era when our politicians all tend to run into each other, to have someone like Seward, who's monstrous in many ways, but also a staunch patriot. So this is a man who, if he does anything, it's going to be in neon lights, and he isn't simply motivated by ego, although he had a huge ego, or ambition, although he had unboundless ambition. He also was a genuine patriot. He's literally a character out of a novel. And when he made mistakes, they were the size of Cleveland. I mean, they could be devastating. But he wasn't afraid to own up to them. And you can see that in the Trent Affair, which is a very one of those fascinating and what-if moments in American history, where Britain and America almost did come to blows in the Civil War in 1861.
So this is a thwarted Confederate mission to petition overseas for assistance from France and from Britain, almost caused a declaration of war by Britain against the Union.
That is correct. Again, to give it a modern perspective, the crux of the matter is that there are two Confederate envoys, unofficial ambassadors, you could say, James Murray Mason, who was being sent to London, and John Slidell, who was being sent to Paris. And they were traveling on a British mail boat, and the boat was intercepted. It was forced to stop on the high seas by a U.S. naval captain called Charles Wilkes. The diplomats were taken off and brought back to the U.S. and put into prison in Boston. And if that were to happen today, the equivalent would be if an American Airlines plane was forced to land, say, in Canada by Iranian fighter pilots, and then two Iranian dissidents were taken off and hauled back to Iran, and the American Airlines plane was then allowed to go on its way. Mm. I mean, this country would never, ever stand for that kind of interference and insult. And would immediately declare, demand an apology, demand the return of the dissidents, and declare war if those terms weren't met. And that's what Britain did. I had to do in the eyes of the world, or else it would have been humbled and humiliated by this much smaller country. The problem was that the papers, in some stupid and unreasoning way, whipped up the public into a frenzy and said this was a poke in the eye to Britain. It was a marvelous thing. In no way should we return these two southern diplomats. We must stand up to Britain. And the cabinet became caught up in this frenzy. And even Lincoln was actually guilty of being caught up in this. And only Seward was clear-headed enough to realize what a horrendous mistake had been made. And only he had the courage to stand up and say, no, we cannot even enter into a negotiation. We must stand firm and say we're sorry. It was this was a misunderstanding, and we must return these diplomats. And that is what makes him great, that he was able to do that and able to persuade the cabinet in an emergency session on Christmas Day that this should be the case. And so then the diplomats were sent back. He then wrote a sort of hilarious explanation to the public that was full of sophistry and completely mad and inside out, pure kind of Sewardisms all over the place, which the public bought, and it saved his career.
And one of the sort of face-saving solutions contained therein was the fact that this was actually done without official instructions by the commander of that U.S. naval vessel.
That's right, and as indeed it had been. I mean, no one had actually been given instructions to do that. Seward somehow managed to compare it to impressment, which was the cause of the War of 1812, when the British were stopping American ships and taking off British sailors who had run away from the Navy in order to get them to bring them back to fight in the war against Napoleon. And there was a lot of questions about whether these British sailors were actually now American citizens or not, and that kind of thing. So, yes, that's how they got around it. But the two people, there are three people, really, who were most responsible for stopping Britain and America going into war. One was Seward. The other was Lord Lyons, who very tactfully was able to bend his own instructions in order to give Seward as much latitude as he needed to save face as he was working things out with the cabinet. And the third person was Prince Albert, back in London, who read the government's letter of demands before it left Britain and arrived in Washington, D.C., and realized that it contained language that was so strong and so harsh that the Lincoln administration could never agree to its demands without losing face. And he changed the language and the wording so that instead of being accusatory, it was conciliatory, and recognized that a mistake had been made, took out any implication that this act had been done on purpose, that kind of thing, and so opened all the doors for a graceful exit.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're speaking with Amanda Foreman about her book, A World on Fire, Britain's Crucial Role in the American Civil War. Let's go on the phone now to Paul in Mesquite. Hi, Paul.
Hi. My question or my comment is about slave revolts. The one specifically I'm thinking about is Nat Turner, who basically said in his confessions that one of the reasons that he wanted to take his troops, eventually develop these troops that go to capture this fort, was because he wanted to try to bring Britain in on the side of the slaves to try to crush slavery. And I'm wondering if your guests have any comments about those particular kickbacks. I think there were like a number of slave revolts that happened specifically because Britain had actually declared slavery illegal. And I know the one with Nat Turner happened right around that time when Britain did so.
Amanda?
You know, the Britain's relationship with America, and specifically around slavery, was, very, very complicated, going right back to the War of Independence. If you remember then, Britain promised freedom to any black slave who fought on the side of the loyalists against the colonists. And then after the war, many of those black soldiers were taken to Canada to start afresh. So I think there's always been this expectation that Britain would guarantee freedom to anyone who could kind of get themselves onto British soil or get themselves into the hands of, the British authorities. You know, the great irony, though, is that during the Civil War, when the South began its blockade running activities to try and get past the federal blockade of southern ports, it relied on the Caribbean islands to be their sort of staging post between the South and Liverpool and other European ports. And the commerce was so successful for these islands, whether it was the Bahamas, for example, that many of the blacks, black inhabitants of these islands, supported the South against the North. And in Turks and Caicos, for example, there were reports that the U.S. consul there was continually harassed by black laborers and harbor workers who just felt that he was a massive impediment to the commerce that was happening and bringing a lot of wealth to the island. So it's sort of fascinating, the twists and turns of this anti-slavery story.
That brings us nicely to the other giant sticking point here, which was the construction of warships ordered by the Confederacy from British shipyards.
Yeah, that really is, because you know, it's one of those unfortunate issues where the facts on the ground and then the complications behind it are very hard to marry up. So the facts on the ground are that the Confederates took advantage of legal loopholes in Britain to build its commerce raiders. And the most important of these was the CSS Alabama that sank over 60 northern ships. There was no loss of life, of course. They would always take the passengers and crew off first before sinking the ship. But this enterprise was so successful that the Confederacy destroyed the U.S. Merchant Marine during the war, because no U.S. merchant ship could get insurance. It was just too high. And so it had a really devastating economic impact. And the blame for this was laid at Britain's door for allowing the Confederates to secretly build these ships, the Florida, the Alabama, etc., in British ports. Now, the problem was, though, that the law in Britain stated that, you know, you couldn't simply just come to England, and, you know, build a warship and take it off and, you know, start firing at people. But the law didn't specify that you couldn't build a ship that looked somewhat warlike. And so the Confederates rather cleverly built their warships, their raiders, to have the capability to carry cannons, but didn't actually arm them with cannons. So they would leave British shores and then get all their arms and, you know, war material in somewhere else. And so that's how they managed to get around it.
Explain, Amanda, why the British government ultimately declared neutrality in the conflict rather than taking a side.
Well, actually, that happened very quickly on, and that was in response to Lincoln's announcement of a blockade of southern ports. Just before the Civil War broke out, the Crimean War had ended, and that had caused such bloodshed, such agony, that the great powers involved in the Crimean War, which is essentially, I should say, Britain, France against Russia, they tried to kind of, you know, set up some rules of warfare, and one of them laid down the rules of when and how a country can blockade the ports of another country, and in among those rules. It's called the Declaration of Paris. Among those rules was that if a country decided to blockade another country, then it had to announce the blockade, had to say we are now, you know, Britain is now blockading England, and then it had to send ships and actually have an effective blockade. And, you know, you couldn't just send a little rowboat over and say, I've now got a blockade of, you know, Liverpool. You actually had to kind of send over your naval ships. And then any other country that tried to sail into Liverpool did so at its peril, and if its ships got caught or taken prisoner, well, so be it. That was their fault. So that's what the rule was. But the second rule said that, you know, a country can't blockade itself. This is an act of war. It's an international act of war. So, you know, Washington D.C. can't announce a blockade of New York. It could physically announce it, but no other country would have to recognize that. It's not a real blockade. So when Lincoln announced a blockade of all southern ports, what he was in fact announcing was that the North was blockading a separate country known as the South. And so Britain had to decide, you know, which way it was going to leap. Was it going to say, well, I'm very sorry, I'm not going to recognize this blockade because the South isn't a separate country and we want our cotton and we want to have trade with the South, so Nabu sucks to you? Or was it going to say, yes, okay, fine, we will recognize this blockade, we will let our merchant ships be captured and our sailors thrown in prison if that's what happens to them, because this is a legal blockade of a separate country. And, I mean, it's a really terrible choice, actually, offered to international countries. Anyway, so Britain said, fine, okay, it's a blockade. We won't protest, i.e. we'll stay neutral when British merchant ships sail over to the south and are captured by U.S. Blockading ships. So that's why Britain declared neutrality.
Talk a little bit about the press coverage and how this was followed as a story from Britain.
Well, that's the nub of the answer. And earlier on in this program, we were talking about opinion and how at the very beginning of the war, foreign opinion, especially British opinion, was behind the North. But as the war progressed, British opinion became firmly on the side of the South. And why is that? Well, as we know, one reason is because of the way Seward handled the international diplomacy and used Britain and in a way that angered Britain and British public opinion. The second reason, though, is that once the war was underway, the message that came out of the North was that this was a war to preserve the Union. And while that was a unifying cry in the Union, because it allowed the border states to stick with the upper states, across the Atlantic, what it meant was that Southern propagandists could say, you see, this is a war about territory for the North and a war about freedom and the right to self-determination for the South. Hmm. One side is fighting for empire, one side is fighting for liberty. And, I mean, it was the most terrible elemental mistake, actually, that the North could make by allowing the South to grab onto the flag of freedom, liberty, right to self-determination. Because once you say, I'm a freedom fighter, it's very difficult for others to kind of, you know, get the moral high ground. And the press loves freedom fighters. So that's how the South managed to become popular in England.
My guest is Amanda Foreman. She's visiting research fellow at Queen Mary, University of London. Her book is called A World on Fire, Britain's Crucial Role in the American Civil War. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Historian Amanda Foreman is my guest. She's visiting research fellow at Queen Mary, University of London, and author of A World on Fire, Britain's Crucial Role in the American Civil War. The number to call to join the conversation is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. Amanda, what do we know about the number of British people who, for any number of reasons, actually took up arms in the conflict in the Civil War?
Well, people have tried to count them, and we'll never have an accurate figure because many regiments either didn't record nationality, or especially in the South. So we'll never really know, but Ella Lon, about 50 years ago, began to try to make sense, and she reckoned that there were at least 35,000 Englishmen alone who volunteered. So, you know, I mean, you're talking about, you know, tens of thousands of Britons who volunteered on both sides, and that's not including the Irish, which are in the hundreds of thousands.
I was really interested to read that there were at least some mill workers in Britain who had an affinity with the North, despite the fact that as the war dragged on, their jobs were threatened. They still were so vehemently anti-slavery that they could not support the South.
That's right. And not even some, I would say it was the majority of mill workers. And part of the reason is because they, in a kind of classic Marxist sense, really understood what it meant to own the fruits of their labor. And so no matter what you said to them, they understood that crucial difference between, you know, what people might call wage slavery and actual slavery, and literally over their dead bodies where they're going to support the South and its slave system. And this is one of the reasons, actually, that the call for political reform became stronger and stronger during and after the Civil War, that working men should have the vote, because as the subsequent Prime Minister, William Gladstone, said, for them to have, these workers to have that kind of political sophistication to hold back, to be able to see the long term and to act upon principle and not take to the streets and demand that Britain support the South and get cotton, end the cotton famine, end this war and bring things back to normal. For them to not do that, but to suffer, starve, suffer low or no employment throughout the war on the basis of a principle, really showed that the working classes deserved the vote.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones now to James in Carrollton. Hi, James.
All I wanted to say was there is a town located on the county line between Wise and Denton County, and it's named after Slidell, the gentleman that was on the British packet ship going to London.
Yeah, thanks for your call. A lot of places in this part of the country certainly are named after the Americans who were involved in the Civil War. Any similar commemorations, Amanda, of people in Great Britain?
Well, there are a lot of plaques in and around Great Britain, especially in London. There's a plaque which shows where the Confederacy had its secret service offices and things like that. You know, where Charles Francis Adams had his residence and where the embassy was during the war. In fact, you can take a Civil War tour in London. It's organized by Queen Mary University, and they have tour guides that will show you where you know, the various skullduggery and secret dealings were going on. And then you can go to Liverpool and see, again, where the Confederates had their offices and where the Alabama was built and that kind of stuff. So the Civil War is not only alive and well, but beginning to thrive. There are even Civil War reenactors in England who reenact the Battle of Gettysburg, you know, on Salisbury Plain in England.
You know, you mentioned the Confederate Secret Service, and we haven't had much time to talk about this very fascinating aspect of the book. The Confederacy quite successfully utilized women as spies.
Yes, they did. The most famous of those was Rose Greenough, often known as Rebel Rose, and she was one of those extraordinary people who could whip men and women around to their to bend their will towards to whatever, you know, she wanted them to do or say. I mean, I think she was clearly mesmerizing in her ability to persuade people to do things for her. And she was sent over in 1863 by the Confederate President Jefferson Davis to meet with the Prime Minister Palmerston and the Emperor of France to see if she couldn't persuade them into supporting the South. She obviously didn't succeed in that, but she was very successful in helping to turn upper class public opinion, especially in Britain, but also in France and Paris, towards the South. She just had that kind of hypnotic and magnetic personality that some people do. But she, sadly, for her family and her, drowned on her way back to the South, within sight of Wilmington. And one of the reasons why she drowned was that she was carrying a great deal of gold, and she'd sewn it into her dress. And when the ship was intercepted by northern blockaders, she got into a rowboat and trying to get away from them, and a swell of huge waves tossed over the rowboat, emptied out the occupants into the sea. And unlike the men, she couldn't shed her clothes, and she was dragged down to the bottom and drowned.
You know, if you were writing this as a novel, Amanda, you couldn't come up with something like that in fiction and make it believable. It's such a remarkable story.
Yes. Yeah. And she herself actually wrote her about her imprisonment in a prison, in the capital prison in D.C. She spent nearly a year there, and she wrote about that. And she herself, she was a pretty good writer, and it does, her own account, reads a bit like a novel, and probably there are some novelistic aspects to it.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Ian in Fort Worth. Hi, Ian.
Oh, hello. Good to hear your voice back on there.
Thank you.
I have a what-if question, you might call it. I've been reading about the war and since coming here. It's occurred to me occasionally, if England had joined the Confederate South, would Lincoln have had to sue for peace, or would he have been thoroughly beaten? I don't see how he could have won against England and the South, to be honest.
Well, I agree with the caller, to be honest. I think that if Britain had come in on the side of the South, it would have been all up for the North. First of all, if Britain had recognized Southern independence, then the rest of the world would have gone with Britain. I mean, possibly, maybe, the Russians, who were still furious with Britain and France over the Crimean War, might have gone on the side of the North because it wanted a rematch over the Crimean War. But apart from that, the rest of the world would have immediately begun trading with the South again. The South were unable to easily get volunteers, raise funds, do all the things that it had been unable to do because the rest of the world was respecting the Northern blockade. And just think of the massive demoralization of U.S. public opinion that would have followed once it knew that the rest of the world was against them. It really would have been very, very different. I guess it does depend slightly on the timing. You know, if Britain had recognized Southern independence in 1865, it would have meant a lot less than if Britain had recognized Southern independence in 61, 62, or even 63.
Of course, I mean, it may not have lasted very long if the rest of the world had joined in, but am I correct? Are you implying that there could have, in fact, been a world war had Britain declared war on the Union?
Yes, I think there could have been because that's one of the reasons why it's one of the reasons, not the only reason, but it's one of the reasons why Britain did not recognize the South was because, you know, it was always much more concerned about the relationship between the great powers. And the great powers, they were always vying with each other, looking for an angle, looking for a way to thwart the other so that Britain couldn't be certain that either the French or the Russians might use the war in America as a way of stabbing Britain in the back, and the British couldn't even be sure that the U.S. itself might suddenly not turn around and stab Britain in the back. So that, for example, Britain recognizes the South, and then Russia comes in on the side of the North. Britain and France are fighting on the side of the Confederacy. But then the Confederacy starts to make inroads into Mexico. France then turns against, and where France has installed its puppet leader, France then turns against the South and then comes on the side of the North. I mean, any number of possible permutations. So this wasn't. It didn't make sense for Britain to risk its political capital by going down on one side or the other.
How did the assassination of Abraham Lincoln shift the tide of British opinion once again?
Well, it's just one of those marvelously ironic things that a week before Lincoln's assassination, Punch magazine, which was one of the most influential and widely read magazines, it was a kind of political magazine with a satirical bent, had likened him to an ape and one of the great failures of modern politics. And then the minute he was assassinated, it had this Pauline conversion and suddenly realized that it had been wrong all the time and that Lincoln had actually been a force for good, that everything he'd done had been, the mistakes he'd made were not his fault, and that he was a man of great vision, a man of great clemency, a man of great foresight. And it actually published a public apology to say that we were wrong, that we should have given him much more respect than we did. And as far as I know, it's the only magazine or newspaper in journalistic history to publicly apologize for its policies and to admit that he had been completely and utterly wrong.
So what did it take to sew up the relationship between these two countries once the war was over and the United States was focused on Reconstruction?
Well, but, you know, it's one of those things where, again, in a family argument where, you know, some relative tries to stay neutral and it ends up infuriating both sides. And even after the two sides are reconciled, they're now reconciled because they're furious at the other relative, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened with Britain, that at the end of the war, the North and South, you know, they're making their painful, slow reconciliation. But the one thing that does unite them is they're both furious with Britain. The South is furious with Britain because it didn't help them enough, and the North is furious with Britain because it, you know, it feels it helped the South too much and wasn't neutral enough. It ended in 65. It took 7 years of wrangling and protracted negotiations and accusations until finally in 1872, There was an arbitration in Geneva where the two sides came together and thrashed out their differences. And Britain paid over $3 million in gold and reparations for not preventing the Alabama from leaving Liverpool and for its failure to stop the Confederates from building their commerce raiders in Britain. And the U.S. Also paid reparations for its treatment of British subjects living in America who had their property unlawfully taken from them or they were unlawfully imprisoned. And indeed, one woman named Mary Hill, a British nurse living in New Orleans at the time, who was imprisoned without charge but accused of spying for the South, sued the U.S. government on the back of this arbitration agreement, and won $400 in compensation for that. I mean, quite a feat, actually, for a woman to do that in those days.
It's almost like everybody involved simply needed to hear the other side apologize.
Yes, isn't there a song about that? Sometimes sorry is the hardest word to say.
Well, I'm so glad we're all getting along much better these days.
Yes.
Amanda Foreman is Visiting Research Fellow at Queen Mary University of London. We've been talking this hour about her book, A World on Fire, Britain's Crucial Role in the American Civil War. The book is available now in paperback. Amanda, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. You can learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download the daily podcast. It's always free at kera.org/think. If you have comments, questions, or suggestions to share, send those along to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.